Three little words, achingly familiar on a Western farmer's tongue, rule life today in the dust bowl of the continent. If it rains. Robert Geiger, Associated Press writer, Dateline Guymon, Oklahoma, April 15, 1935. These were the storytellers, the reporters whose words, the photographers whose pictures, and the songwriters whose lyrics let people know what other people were going through. Their dispatches from the field are short on policy analysis and on the opinions of distant experts, but they're long on humanity. They're long on the dignity of people. These were some of journalism's finest moments, done under pressure. 77 years later, such moments are still happening. The best of them, I tell you, are still yet to come. We'll have time later in this conference to overanalyze and fret and worry about the state of journalism, because that's really what we do. But for tonight, at least, we're here to shake off the blues and celebrate, to embrace the skill, the sacrifice, the commitment, and the humanity that have held this little band together for so long and that bind us to the world. We're here to honor our own victories and those of our colleagues, and to renew our individual and collective strength. Ladies and gentlemen, we're here tonight and this week to affirm that some things will never change, that stories will always matter, and that the truth will always rise. I'd like the following people to stand up and be recognized. All the members of the Board of Directors of the Society of Environmental Journalists, please stand and remain standing, and please don't hold your applause till the end. And I'd like any former board members who are in the room, please stand up as well. And keep standing. I want all SEJ members who are organizing tours, sessions, anything like that this weekend, please stand up. I'd like all the guest speakers at any of those things to please stand up. I'd like anybody from Texas Tech University, our host, the best host in the history of the SEJ, to please stand up. I would like any other academic members or students, please stand up. Anyone who has come here from Mexico, where our colleagues risk their lives to do what we take for granted, please stand up. And I'd like anybody from any other country, please stand up. Yeah. I'd like anybody who's attending their very first SEJ annual conference to stand up. Now I want everybody who believes in the power of right words and images and sounds to heal this world, please stand up. Now, as a community, let us declare open this 22nd annual conference of this amazing organization. Okay, now you can sit down. It is my second pleasure this evening to introduce our host of hosts, Kent Hance, the Chancellor of the Texas Tech University System. Now, those of you not from Texas may not understand that what that means is he gets to boss a bunch of people around, not just one. Now, I'm going to tell you about the first time I ever met the Chancellor. He has no reason to remember this, but it was 1990, and he was running for governor of Texas. He lost. But I did find him to be the funniest of the candidates running, or at least the funniest of the Republicans. Now, if you want to think about a funny Republican, I guess you can. Unfortunately, the winner that year was pretty funny, too. It was Ann Richards. But I took with me the understanding that this was a guy who understood people, in addition to understanding politics and policy and economics and all of that stuff. And I could go on and on about his distinguished resume, member of Congress, member of the Texas Railroad Commission, on and on and on. Very successful private attorney. But all I can tell you is that through Kent's support of this conference from the very first moment it was proposed, that's where this success has arisen. So, without any other ado, Kent Hance.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That's fine. Thank you. We are thrilled that you're here. Mayor Glenn Robertson, my friend that's mayor of Lubbock, stand up. A great mayor. He worked with us. We wanted y'all here. We wanted to expose you to Texas Tech. We like for visitors to come in. And most of the time they leave impressed. Some of them, like West Virginia, they leave 49-14. Those things happen. You know, I've been chancellor for 6 years, and I'd been chancellor about a month, and a guy came in to see me, a professor, and great guy, and he came in, and he said he needed to talk to me, and he said, I'm not getting paid enough. And I said, I understand that. And he said, my office is too small. And he said, my parking space is too far away. His computer was out of date, and he needed a new copy machine. He had a lot of problems. And I said, I wish I had 100 just like you. He said, really, why? I said, because right now I've got 2,000 just like you. I got him laughing and got him out the door. We did get his pay up eventually. But congratulations on being here. I want to tell you just a little about Texas Tech is that the number one thing that speaks about us are our graduates. And I'm going to give you a few. When the White House and Congress had problems at General Motors and went bankrupt, they didn't call on someone from Harvard, Yale, or Stanford. They got a Texas Tech graduate, Ed Whitaker, to turn it around. By the way, he's the only person in the history of the world that's been CEO and chairman of the board of two of the 10 largest companies in the world, AT&T, General Motors, and he serves on the board at Exxon. He is the first person in his family to ever go to college. And at Texas Tech, the motto is dream no little dreams. If you're going to dream little dreams, go to OU or Texas. No, I'm just kidding about that. I mean, I just threw that in to see if y'all were awake. Forbes magazine, every year, they list the 100 most powerful women in the world. Angela Braly's been on that list every year. In fact, one year, about 4 years ago, she was number fourth most powerful woman in the world. And I called her and said, congratulations. I said, I was impressed. You were ahead of Hillary Clinton and Oprah Winfrey. She said, my little sisters were impressed I was ahead of Queen Elizabeth. I like that. If you go to the New York Metropolitan Opera, the lead soprano, the number one rated mezzo-soprano in the world, is Susan Graham. She has 2 music degrees from Texas Tech. If you watch CBS Evening News, the anchor, Scott Pelley, is a Texas Tech grad. He's also one of the lead investigative reporters for 60 Minutes. He called me one time, and I said, are you calling as a friend, or are you calling for 60 Minutes? He said, as a friend. I said, good. I'll go ahead and talk to you. But he's a great guy. In the Persian Gulf, the USS Abraham Lincoln was there protecting our interest in the Strait of Hormuz. And the captain of the ship, commander of the fleet, was John Alexander, a 1985 mechanical engineering graduate of Texas Tech. The past president of the Iraqi Trade Bank, Hussein al-Yuziri, is a 1985 electrical engineering graduate of Texas Tech. And the leading receiver for the last 5 years in the NFL, Wes Welker, is a Texas Tech graduate. And 2 years ago, on Mother's Day, when the Oakland A's needed someone to throw a perfect game, a no-hit perfect game, nobody got on base, they called on Dallas Lee Braden, a Texas Tech graduate. So our people excel. And dream no little dreams is what we're about. We have a cross-section, and I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. But we have a cross-section of America. We're one of the few schools, we're the only school in Texas that has a law school, a medical school, and undergraduate school all on the same campus. We're one of 8 schools in the nation that have 2 medical schools. We have one here. We have one in El Paso. The El Paso school opened in 2007. We got one of our friends in El Paso, a Texas Tech person, to give us a gift to endow the medical school. He gave us $50 million. His granddad was in the first class at Texas Tech in 1925 and lived to be 103 and was not in the hospital until he was 103. And he got to see his grandson do that. We've got some great stories. I teach a class on leadership. One day after the class, we were talking about immigration. And a kid came up, and he said, Mr. Chancellor, I think my parents are the original illegal aliens. I said, I don't know how to say that. I said, they're not old. I don't know your parents, but they're not old enough to be undocumented workers. And he tells me the story. This kid went to Texas Tech, graduated in 6 years. He never borrowed money. He worked his way through. He's now teaching American history in high school. Now, that by itself is a great story. The next time the class met, I had a kid come up and introduce himself, and he said, Chancellor, my granddad says you're a good friend of his. I said, what's your granddad's name? He said, James Baker. I said, James Baker? He said, James A. Baker. Really? Secretary of Treasury under Reagan, Secretary of State under Bush 41? He said, that's Pawpaw. I said, well, I'm going to call Pawpaw and make him speak at graduation. I called Baker, and Baker said, he comes home and tells all those stories you tell, and you used to use them in Washington. I said, Baker, I'm into recycling. I want to keep those stories going. And he agreed to come out and speak at Coulter's graduation. And by the way, he said, what happens if I come out and speak at his graduation and he doesn't graduate? I said, look, if you come out and speak, he'll have on a cap and gown. It'll look like he graduated. By the way, the kid did not need any help. Now, the reason I tell that story, in one class, and there were only 2 people seated between those 2 young men, and in one class, you have one kid whose mother and dad, his mother's a dishwasher and his dad's a fry cook in a cafe in Lubbock, and the other one His dad knows most leaders in the world on a first-name basis, and they're getting the same great education. That's what we stand for. The greatest enemy of poverty and war is education, and that's what we talk about. Dream no little dreams. We ask people to come to Texas Tech. We recruit. We've grown. We've got almost 33,000 students. We were 32,700 this year. We also have Angelo State, and that's a school in San Angelo. It's got 7,000 students. We've got 3 pharmacy schools, 5 nursing schools, and that we care about the students. And our students, we encourage them to change the world and to be involved. And they'd be good members of this association. I appreciate what you do. My dad in 1925 was 16 years of age. He left Bonham, Texas, a little town by Bonham called Randolph. And he had a grocery sack with his clothes in it and $1.35. And his sister, his older sister, lived on a ranch northwest of here at Dimmitt, Texas, where I grew up. And my dad hitchhiked. And by the way, one funny story, he made it to Wichita Falls the first day, and that's pretty good, 1925. He got there, and the guy let him out, and there was he only had $1.35, and there was a store that said donuts, and had a little sign that said day old donuts, 6 for a nickel. And he went over there and bought him 6 because he's trying to budget his money. And he got to talking to the guy that owned the store, and the guy felt sorry for him and asked him, where you spend the night? And he said, it's that park. And he let him sleep in that donut shop. And he told him, during the night, you can have all the day-old donuts that you want, because tomorrow there'll be two-day-old donuts. And he came back the next morning and started cooking donuts at 4 o'clock. And when my dad left, caught a ride at 7 o'clock, he gave him another 6 donuts. My dad died in 1981. He never ate another donut from that time to the day he died. He'd smell those donuts and eat them. I mean, it's all he could take.
At this point, Jay Leto and I've got to be really good buddies, you know. We talk a lot, anyway, Jay and I were kicking around ideas about maybe some musical entertainment tonight, and I threw out an idea, and we kind of worked the problem a little bit, but a friend of ours, we contacted him and inquired about coming, and we've had several emails and communications and visits, this friend, he said, I want to come, and I want to be here. But there's only one other thing that will keep me from not coming, is that if the Rolling Stones go on tour. Does that get your attention? And so I actually have, and I got it here for you, Jay, an email from Mick Jagger to Chuck Leavell saying, you got to come to Europe in October. And so we've got a problem. We're here in October, but Chuck is in Paris right now, and he's sending you a welcome, and we're going to show it to you. But we just got this a few days ago, and I think it's kind of cool. So anyway, Jay?
Hi, guys. Chuck Leavell coming to you all the way from Paris, France, where we are rehearsing with the Rolling Stones and having big fun playing these wonderful songs again after all these years. And we're preparing for some shows that will happen before the year is out. So we're all very excited about that. But I'm sorry I can't be there with you in person. I know the Society of Environmental Journalists is a great, great group. We have many things in common, trying to spread the word about the environmental challenges that we all have. And I want to thank you for the great work that all of you do in spreading this word and getting people to better understand the challenges and the solutions that we do have. We're trying to do the same thing with our environmental website, the Mother Nature Network, that I know many of you are familiar with, and that's www.mnn.com, so please visit us if you haven't already. But I hope you have a great conference. I'll be thinking about you, and maybe next year I can be there with you guys, okay? All the best, and we're going to sign off with a little music. How about that? Get some satisfaction with your conference. Have a great time. All the best.
So anyway, Beth Park, we will do our best to try to get him to Tennessee next year. And he really wanted to be here. So anyway, have a great conference. Thanks for being here. Welcome to Lubbock, Texas. And you are in West Texas. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to introduce the mayor of Lubbock, Texas, the Honorable Glenn Robertson. And it's a pleasure to have him here. And he's a busy man, a successful businessman. And we visited some time ago, and he just thought this was terrific to have you guys come here. And so he wanted to be here tonight to present you with a special welcome. So anyway, Mayor Robertson, come to the podium, please.
Thank you all. First thing I want to do is just really thank you for choosing Lubbock. You do not know how much it means to our community to have you here. I feel like I ought to be nervous being a politician in a room this full of media, but you ought to make me comfortable, and I appreciate it. On behalf of the citizens of Lubbock and the City Council of Lubbock, I would like you to welcome here. I would like for you to enjoy our hospitality. You'll see things in Lubbock that you're probably not used to seeing. Folks are going to drive by you in a pickup truck and they're waving. They just want to know they're saying hi. We're glad you're here. We hope you enjoy our hospitality. I do have a proclamation that I'd like to read. It's from the City of Lubbock, special recognition. Whereas this year marks the 22nd anniversary of the founding of the Society of Environmental Journalists, making it the world's oldest and largest membership association of professional journalists, educators, and students. And whereas the Society of Environmental Journalists maintains an active membership of individuals around the world who are committed to a high-quality journalism that elevates public awareness and knowledge of environmental issues. And whereas the Lubbock community is proud to host this year's conference and excited to see others explore the past and present environmental issues native to West Texas. Now, therefore, we, the Mayor and City Council of the great city of Lubbock, do hereby recognize October 17th, 2012, as Society of Environmental Journalists Day. And encourage all Lubbock citizens to applaud the dedication and integrity of the journalists gathered for this conference and to take note of environmental issues affecting our community and other regions around the globe. It's dated this 17th day of October 2012, signed by myself, Glenn Robertson, the mayor, and the rest of the city council. Once again, thank you all for being here. Dr. Kendall, thank you and Texas Tech University for getting you here, and we really hope you enjoy your stay. Thank you.
Take that, Miami. I got to organize my script here. Ah, there. There's what I was looking for. All right. I'm now going to introduce Tali Newman. Tali is the co-founder of the 18-year-old bilingual media group, Journalism to Raise Environmental Awareness, which, among other things, publishes the U.S.-Mexico Citizen Journalism Project, Melon Coyote. While producing the most recent issue, she discovered her interview subject tonight, Valer Austin, and proposed to bring Austin to Lubbock. Tali.
Well, I'm going to start introducing Valer Austin. And Valer is an Arizona rancher who also, I found out just now, is also a Texas rancher. And she has conservation watershed restoration projects. And these all have come about since she became a transplant from New York. So she started the foundation Cuenca Los Ojos. And in the time that she has been out here in Arizona and Texas, she has restored 12,500 acres of dry land with tens of thousands of micro dams in a water restoration strategy that has been gaining traction worldwide for the past several decades. We discovered her and got her into High Country News earlier this year. And also, after that, Oprah magazine, O magazine, did an article on Valer Austin. So, welcome, Valer. And what, could you tell us, why do you call your organization Cuenca Los Ojos?
Oh, Cuenca is a watershed. And Ojos is springs, so it's a watershed of springs. Cuenca also is as part of the eye here, and Ojos is eye. So it is a double meaning. It means a new way of seeing things, and also we work in watersheds, so watershed of springs. So, and it's a Mexican foundation, so.
The location is at the headwaters of the Yaqui River, which is the most important river in Sonora, the state just south of Arizona. So could you set the scene for us and tell us about the geography, exactly where this is at, and the size and the shape, and then maybe a little bit of the history, too?
All right. Well, we are working in the Four Corners area of New Mexico, Arizona, Chihuahua, and Sonora. And this is a very interesting area because it is one of the most biodiverse regions in the North American hemisphere. And the reason being, you have the Rocky Mountains meeting the Sierra Madres, and you have the Chihuahuan Desert meeting the Sonoran Desert. And as everyone in this room, because you're environmentalists, know that where you have four distinct biodiverse areas, you have a tremendous amount of overlap in species. So it is a very, very rich area. People looking at the desert look out there and say, oh, there's nothing there. We have more bee species in our area than anywhere else in the world. That's just to give you an example of the types of things that you don't see right away. It is a great migratory corridor, animals coming up from Mexico and birds from South America. We probably have over 400, 450 species of birds that come through there. So it's a very biodiverse, very rich area with few roads, few houses. That area, when you're looking from outer space, is one of the black regions at night, so you don't see a lot of lights, which means that this is an area worth focusing on for conservation.
Okay, and now this is located in the very southeast corner of Arizona in the Chiricahua Mountains, right?
Well, the Chiricahua Mountains, yes, they're part, yes. Chiricahua Mountains run sort of down into the Sierra Madres in Mexico. So you have animals going up the mountain ranges and then going up the valleys. You have four mountain ranges and four valleys running north and south in this region. And that's where we're working.
It's the, near Douglas, Arizona, and Agua Prieta, Mexico. So,
Tali, one thing I would like to mention is that the border wall is a real problem for this migratory animals. Also, there's a highway four-lane highway going through there now in Mexico, and they're widening that. So that's going to be a real issue for the animals.
Mm-hmm. Now, we thought at first that, well, heck, it's always been a desert. Everybody knows the famous Sonora Desert, the famous Chihuahua Desert. So why does Valer Austin want to turn it into a wetlands? And I think that you could maybe explain that to us in its historical context, no?
Historically, the San Bernardino Valley, where we're working, was a wetlands. It was a huge wetlands in the middle of a desert. What could be more valuable than a huge wetlands in the middle of a desert for migratory animals? From earliest times, Indians were located in that region because there were springs. And then the Spaniards came in and brought their cattle and all that came with it. And so that area became overgrazed for a while, but the Apaches came in there and they threw everybody out. And so for a long time, those Sierra Madres were, Aldo Leopold called them the only area that he'd seen that was not sick land, because the Apaches were holding force there, and so it kept other people out. But what happened in the 1880s, 1850s to 1880, people came from the East Coast into that southwest region, and they saw grasses up to your waist, and they said, oh my God, this is tremendous. So they started grazing down those lands. And in the process also, they started cutting down trees in the hills because they discovered mines, copper mines. So they wanted the lumber to shore up the mines. So you had two things going on. You had the depletion of the forests along the mountains, and you had a depletion of grasses in the valleys. I've got to put this down. So you have, I talk with my hands, you have all this mountain range where we're collecting all the water into a basin down in the San Bernardino Valley, and the water was rushing off the hills because they didn't have any trees to hold it or anything, and the ground in the valley was like concrete because it was trodden down and it was hard and it was baked in the sun. Huge droughts came in the late 1800s, 1890s in there. All the cattle died off. Thousands and thousands were lying, dead cattle on the ground. So you have this terrible situation, and then you get the monsoon rains. The monsoon rains came, they couldn't go into the ground. The water was looking for a place, and it found two streams on either side of this cienega, this huge cienega, wetlands. And it down cut in a few years 30 feet. So you get this wetlands that's being drained into these two arroyos on either side of it. And within 10 years, you had dried up this magnificent wetlands in the desert. So the species, plants started dying, species started leaving. It became a here's what it looked like in the 1880s. Now you'll see some pictures. We can show you some pictures of the compacted soil, erosion, huge erosion problems. This is what we saw when we first arrived there 10 years ago. We had previously been working in the Chiricahua Mountains for 20 years, but then we came down here and we started working on these. That's the down cutting you can see, 30 feet. So we started putting in what we call gabions. Here's a gabion. And they're wire baskets filled with rocks, and they're up to 12, 14 feet high. And it holds the when the rains come, the water is filled with this mud. and it holds that mud back, and the mud is deposited, as you can see in these pictures, deposited behind the gabion, and it acts as a sponge. And this sponge holds tons. I mean, it's just tons. It's water. And that water seeps downstream slowly, slowly, slowly. And then downstream several miles, the river starts to run again. So when all the other rivers in this area are drying up, our river of San Bernardino now has 5 miles of running water all year long, which is incredible. So there you can see, I took this picture just a little while ago. You can see the dry gabion down below before the rains, and then you see the waters coming in, and you see the vegetation. This was from 2 years ago. Now the vegetation's coming in. So you see vegetation coming in. There's a gabion that 8 years later, totally filled up. Well, we've got 12 feet of soil behind that gabion. And now the waters can go out over the stream bed the way they used to do and wet the sides. So the Cienega is recreating itself now. The animals are coming back. Birds are coming back. We're doing scientific studies with students from both sides, from UNAM, the University of Mexico, UNISON, the University of Sonora, Arizona State, Biosphere 2 is doing studies on us. So different students from both sides are coming to study the results of what's happening in this valley. These are some pole cuttings downstream, and this one looks 2 years later, or 4 years later maybe. Same picture. So you can see the vegetation coming in, and that vegetation holds the water back also. The reeds lie down. Oh, here is a picture of from satellite imagery. You can't see too well, but you can. We have many more miles of vegetation you can see from satellite.
What inspired you to take on this? How did you get started with micro dams?
We started up in the Chiricahuas 30 years ago. We were noticing a road was washing out. And it was annoying. You know, we had the road kept disappearing. So we put some rocks and some garbage, I have to say. I'm ashamed to say, but ranchers have a lot of that. We stuck it in the wash there, and the road filled up. And we noticed that there were grasses on both sides of the road, and it was always wet there. And we thought, well, if it's wet here, maybe we do it other places because we see what happens. So we started putting them in the hillsides, thousands, 20,000. We stopped counting it, 20,000 of these dams. And grasses started coming in, and the hills started being wet. Then we started putting it in the stream beds, and then the stream started running again. And we got to the point where we could reintroduce a native fish that had long disappeared. So we did the first habitat conservation plan in Arizona for the Yaki chub, which is a little fish. And from then on, you know, scientists started coming out to where we were working and started doing studies about what was happening, how might the increase in birds and wildlife.
Well, we think of working in that area, the first thing that comes to mind is how sensitive and difficult it must be along the border with all kinds of contraband and trafficking and migration and border patrol. And I'm sure that must be, can you talk to us about that, some of the challenges that presents in trying to do this conservation activity?
Well, I'm going to understate it because it's a big problem, and I don't want to get too much into it because I live there, and so I've got to play down. But we've had a lot of problems, so the drugs coming through us and problems that presents. But our gabions actually have had a positive impact because no longer can drug people drive up the washes into the States because of these big gabions, and it's too wet and they can't get up there anymore. We actually had a little controversy with the Border Patrol because they're told by Washington that they have to drive along the road, along the border wall. And I had backed up so much water into the States with my gabions that they weren't allowed to do that anymore. So they were complaining to me about this, but I think that they've since realized that, you know, they're in the riverbed and they're leaving me alone for a while.
Well, that's certainly an interesting tactic. Now, you're not in an isolated context, although you are in an isolated part of the country. There are other groups and governmental organizations that have coalesced around this. Can you tell us about the others?
We decided that this was such an important area that Cuenca Los Ojos should invite people from all over to come and see. So Defenders of Wildlife came out and they said, yes, this is an important corridor. And so we have many people working with us. The Northern Jaguar Project in Mexico, Naturalia, which is an NGO, ONG in Mexico, is working with us. We have several governmental agencies in Mexico, CONAM, CONAFOR, CONABIO.
Those are the National Commission for Biodiversity, National Commission for Forestry, and the National Commission for Protected Areas.
So lots of government agencies are working, and some are even helping finance us. In the United States, we have U.S. Fish and Wildlife is helping us, is financing us. Biophilia, another organization, is helping us. And we have Sky Island. I don't know if you know that organization is working with us.
There's how many organizations altogether?
Probably around 25 working with us. So.
And there is a very nice movie about this project called Harvesting the Rain?
Harvest Rain, yeah.
Harvest
Rain. Cosecha de Agua and Harvest Rain. And it's a very, very nice. We have a website called cuencalosojos.org. So if you are interested in what we're doing, we have a movie on that website. And it's actually award-winning movie. It's very, very good. Somebody came to me and said, we want to do a movie about what you're doing. I said, you're crazy. Nobody would be interested in doing rocks, in looking at rocks. And he said, I'm going to make it interesting. And it is. It's very moving, this film.
Well, so. I look forward to seeing that. And I think before we go, I'd like to have your perspective. I know you talk about looking at systems. And what is your long-term goal?
Well, we have a model on the ground that works, and I really would like this model to be replicated in dry areas around the world where you have lots of labor, if governments would stop building big dams and build these little rock dams throughout the country, these countries in dry places would start greening up. I was on the Indian reservations this last week, and they used to build these dams. And I said, why aren't you doing it now? The Hopi reservation, why have you stopped? And they said, they sent us to schools and we got out of it. And I said, well, why don't you do what your ancestors did? And they said, you know, we're going to start doing it again. So this is what needs to be done in dry areas. We have a model on the ground. We've got rivers running. It works. It's very low technique, very labor intensive, put people to work helping the environment. We're putting water back on the land.
That's really impressive, and I just only can ask you how optimistic you are in terms of the future of the environment on this planet.
I'm not terribly optimistic, unless you guys can turn everybody, people's focus, people's priorities, government's priorities. It has to be. We can't live without water. It's up
Thanks.
To you. I'm putting it in your lap.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Could you hear me?
Oh, you could. That was fabulous. Very good.
I think we just found out there's lots of ways to tell a good story. You can tell one from a chair here, or you can tell a story on the ground, on the earth. I think that's what Valera is doing. We have another really special story to share with you tonight. James Redford and Jill Rosenblum Tidman have come to us to talk about their new film called Watershed, which tells the story of the Colorado River today. We all know the old story of the Colorado. It disappears when it gets into Mexico, etc. But there's a new story happening, and they're going to share with us first the trailer from the film, talk a little bit about it, and after tonight's official program is over, after the SEJ Awards, we will be screening the entire film right here in this room. So please stay with us. You're going to be happy that you did. James Redford writes, produces, and directs for television and film. His latest directorial project, Toxic Hot Seat, is a documentary.
One of the conditions.
It examines the possible health dangers of chemical flame retardants currently used in upholstered furniture in the USA. He's also working again with Karen Pritzker on a new documentary that explores the emerging link between childhood trauma and lifelong health problems and what could be done about it. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the lifelong health problems of the Colorado River and what is being done about it. Ladies and gentlemen, James Redford.
You strike me as a crowd that you actually listen. That's both wonderful and terrifying, because one of the ways I get around public speaking is the idea that people aren't really listening. So you smile and say what you're going to say, and you just get on with it, and you can relax because people. But now, and these are my notes for tonight. So this is going to be really interesting. See how this goes. I'm just going to talk to you about a few things. First, I want to thank you for having me. This is a real honor to talk to all of you. You know, my work as a documentary filmmaker has benefited greatly from the hard work that all of you do. And I can speak to two specific examples I'd like to share with you, just because sometimes it's easier for me to tell stories than to keep on track. So, about 6 years ago, I was making a documentary in North Dakota about the reemergence of traditional practices among Plains Indians in the Northern Plains, and how this generation was embracing traditional spirituality and growing. We were really curious about this, and I was pulling up stakes on that project because it was too sensitive. I was going to create more problems than I was going to solve, and I certainly didn't want to do that. So, and I had a funder who was very interested in Native American issues in Indian country, and I was talking to him in a state of despair and depression and about quitting, and he said, well, you know, he was a really generous guy from Long Island. He said, well, you know, what else is going on out there? Something else we can look at? And my colleague at the time, who's a new SEJ member, Micah Fink, I told him about this conversation with our funder. I said, get on it while the going's good. So Micah did some looking around, and he sent me a link to a story in the Bergen County Record. And this story was called Toxic Legacy. And I said, you got to check this out. And it was about the Ramapo Indians of New Jersey, 49 miles outside of Manhattan, and their plight to seek justice against the Ford Motor Company for dumping for a decade plus toxic waste literally in their backyards with no regard for health or safety. And when I finished reading that series, there's something that happens, I think most of you can relate to it, when you encounter injustice and it gets into your blood and it comes up into your skin and your muscles and your brain, and it just makes you crazy. And when I read this series, I said to Micah, this has got to be it. We have to, because they were in the middle of it. They were actually going to take Ford Motor Company to court to seek damages, and they had Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s law firm, Kennedy Madonna, working with them. They had a number of other legal teams working with them. It's going to be an interesting story. And the authors, I want to have is Jan Berry here somewhere? I think he is. Jan, stand up for a second. Jan is the author of this series. He and other members, Barbara Williams and others in the paper, did a standout job. One of the things I want to mention is not only, I'm sorry, is this really annoying? Is it ringing out to everybody? Yeah. I don't know, am I doing something? Yeah. Is that better? Yeah? The expert, I should know this stuff.
There he is.
Is that better? Okay. So Jan, you know, that story became the groundwork for a movie called Man vs. Ford that I did for HBO. I'm really proud of that. It was a long haul. I think when we started, Jan, we thought, oh, well, you know, maybe this will take a year. You know, 5 years. 5 years later, there we were. And I think when you see the movie, you realize that trying to settle environmental issues in the courtroom is perhaps not the most efficient and rewarding way to do things. So it's a pretty interesting story in that regard. But Jan, you know, one of the things I want to mention is for the work that all of you do, his journalism was priceless. But I would contend that his willingness to participate and be interviewed and be on camera and be a part of the story was equally as valuable, because his facts were critical. But when you see the movie and you see him and you get to know what kind of person he is and how Barbara was, their hearts are there too. And I don't think there's any of you in here today that don't have something going on in your hearts. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here, because, you know, certainly it's not for great financial gain to be doing what you're doing. And so what you're doing is remarkable. And I would encourage all of you to trust yourselves, if you get chances to participate in documentary, trust yourselves to do it and embrace it, because you can offer more than your excellent work. You can offer yourselves as people, and you can be very inspiring. More recently, last February, I started researching a project about TB117, an obscure California technical bulletin that puts chemical flame retardants in upholstered furniture that's bought and sold in California. And because the market's so big in California, all the furniture manufacturers just said, well, heck, let's just put it in everything. It'll make things easier. So basically, U.S. furniture, upholstered furniture, has over the last 35 years contained by weight a percentage of chemical flame retardants. And that was created by this obscure bulletin in the mid-70s. And as it turns out, unfortunately, the chemicals don't really work. They're supposed to keep the foam from burning for 15 seconds by candle flame to provide safety to the consumers and fire protection. Not only do they not work, there are serious questions around the health impacts of these chemicals, ironically, particularly when they do burn, which happens often because they don't work. So looking at this story, trying to figure out what is this thing and why is this going on, and pretty quickly started to see some of the usual cast of characters: chemistry, Big Chem, and their lobbyists. And you go back and you look at the state video from the last 3 or 4 years in the state hearings, and you see them showing up and bringing people in, and you see the disinterested lawmakers, and you see all this playing out. And you're going, wow, that's really interesting. And meanwhile, the science is piling up from so many different organizations about the health impacts of these chemicals. That's not getting anywhere. What's going on here? And so we're looking at all this, trying to get an understanding of why this problem has gone on for 35 years, and big chem, big lobby, and then this is like the legacy of the big tobacco industry. In fact, you'll hear more about the story if you don't know more about it already. So as we were pursuing the story, you know, I am not a journalist by any stretch of the yard. My standards of fact-finding I consider to be fairly stringent, but there certainly aren't at the levels that I'm sure most of you hold yourselves to, have to, or insist on holding yourselves to. But we were making our attempt to really look at both sides of the story, and I had a few interviews with scientists that represent the industry point of view, the chemical industry point of view, the fire safety point of view, and by late April, they were really good. They were reeling off facts and data left and right, and telling very effective stories about how crazy the NRDC was, how in fact these chemicals are completely harmless, and there's a dozen studies that prove this, that this is all overblown, people are paranoid, the media, you media people are playing on the fears of the American public. And, you know, by the end of April, I turned to my partner and I was like, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of sold. How about you? I don't know about this story. I'm not sure where this is going. You know, maybe we need to do a point-counterpoint movie about this topic, because it is interesting, but it seems to me like these guys have sold me on this, that this is really a debatable issue. And then, as we're in the middle of trying to figure all that out, we woke up one day to a startling, startling series that appeared in the Chicago Tribune, a four-part series called Playing with Fire. And I understand that maybe Mike Hawthorne is here. Mike, are you here by any chance? Mike, stand up. Come on, man. Stand up. Come on. So, Playing with Fire, Mike Hawthorne, Tricia Callahan, Sam Rowe, Chicago Tribune writers, been cranking away on this story, unbeknownst to me, for a year. It laid out the story in devastating, revelatory detail of just how much, misinformation was out there, how intricate and polished the campaign had been for decades to mislead the American public about these chemicals, and how much money and power had been plowing away to keep $5 billion annual profits to four chemical companies, and the people running this campaign were the smartest and most well-paid lobbyists that the tobacco industry had well-trained over decades. It was an extraordinary, devastating story. It immediately revealed that much of the testimony that we had gotten from the industry experts was down and out incorrect, and in some cases just simply dishonest. It was obviously a major game changer in the middle of what we thought was a really obscure story. We didn't know where things were going. So we sat back and saw this extraordinary thing happen. As that story started to resonate out, it was like a pebble dropping in the water, and the rings just started to expand outwards. First thing that happened is editorials were being written around the country. Then Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois stepped in, and he got all fired up. And then after that, suddenly, and meanwhile in California, where there had been a legislative block for 5 years, as State Senator Mark Leno had tried to get a bill passed to revise the flame standard, suddenly things started to move, and suddenly Governor Brown suddenly says, hey, guess what? I'm enough of this legislative stuff in Sacramento. We're going to do this administratively. We're going to revise this standard. And then if that wasn't extraordinary enough, suddenly there's a hearing in Washington, D.C., held by Barbara Boxer and Lautenberg, to look at TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, and look specifically at this issue around these flame retardants in relationship to the broader issue around the Toxic Substances Control Act, which also has not been revised since the mid-70s. So it was with total awe that I watched all that unfold. And for me, and I went to a hearing in Sacramento at the end of July, knowing full well that Tricia Callahan was going to be there. And, you know, I guess I got a little giddy with anticipation because she was my version of a movie star. And, you know, I was excited to meet her. And I couldn't, the room was crowded and busy. I was looking around. I couldn't find her anywhere. The hearing was underway. The industry was there with their usual tricks, but now people were laughing because it was evident that this was trickery. All this is going on. I'm like, where is Tricia? Where is Tricia? And at the end of the hearing, I got up to leave, and I look in the back of the room. And there she is at the back of the room, and she just looks like shit. Okay, she's got her computer out. And she is so hassled and working so hard on her laptop, and she hasn't changed clothes in a day or two, and she is cranking to get this thing out, and she's barely aware of anything other than what her job is, what she's doing as a writer and a journalist. And I'm sitting there looking at her. She's like changed. Her work is just such a game changer. I don't know if I was expecting to see someone with a halo or what. But, you know, I will always remember the sight of her sitting there in the corner of the room. It was hot, stuffy, this dank room, just slaving away, doing what she does. And I think, you know, for me to see that, I just want to throw that back out at you, because all of you are going to be in that situation so often. And I just want to say thank you to all of that, and thank all of you for all the hard work you do. And I know that there's a lot of frustrations and that it is hard work, but continue to do that and continue to do your hard work. This film, I'll say briefly, we're going to have a Q&A afterwards. I hope all of you will stick around for it. This film, this is a 101 film about the issues of the Colorado River and the issues of water scarcity in the West. As the Redford Center, I put forth with Jill Tidman to our board and our supporters that, you know, knowing we wanted to do something about water, all those stakeholders around the issue of water were clear about one thing, which is there's a virtual ignorance around the state of affairs for water for the Southwest. And that if we really wanted to be helpful, we could tell a story that just lays the groundwork for a better understanding of exactly what's at stake with the Colorado River and the 30 million plus people that are currently use it, and projections are 50 million by 2040 with climate change increasing. Clearly, this is a really important issue, and I'm going to show you that trailer right now.
The Colorado River and the tributaries that make up her basin define the American West.
In Native American traditions, people consider this the heart of the universe.
Water in the West is our most valuable resource.
It's like 250 miles away where we get our water from. I mean, even the water commutes to LA, come on!
Water, which is so precious, doesn't come like it used to.
This whole notion of the American dream, there really isn't water conservation or any type of environmental anything.
With the Colorado River no longer reaching her delta and greater demand looming, perhaps it's time to embrace a new water ethic.
For me, I could say water is love.
One of the conditions is that we were going to do it differently, or we weren't going to do it at all. The way we considered our water consumption is to improve upon the resource that's delivered to us.
That's where we should be putting our attention, into our own natural landscape right here.
All your problems, they disappear when you're out here on the water. It renews you.
It's time that the river is famous not for the dams, but because the water is flowing all the way to the Gulf of California. That would be great.
The question remains, can restoring a mighty river's connection to the sea open new frontiers of conservation and cooperation?
There's beginning to be hope.
Well, is this better? All right, so I know we want to keep things moving on. So I'll just say this. We're focusing on raising awareness. This is not a doom and gloom project. And that's by design. I think there are very serious, depressing issues that are out there, and I think there's some really good stories and movies out there that lay it out in very stark terms, and I think there's a place for that. We decided to focus, let the people that live in the region explain the situation. And my feeling, having grown up part-time in Utah, is that Westerners don't necessarily respond to doom and gloom. You can't get anywhere by depressing people in Colorado and Utah. And so we have an agenda here to create a greater awareness, broadly speaking, and also use the film to create an action plan, which we're designing. We're having a conference at the Sundance Resort Conference Center in November to put together an action plan with about five different nonprofits to buy 50,000 acre feet of water and get it back down to the Sonoran Desert and return the Colorado River to the Sea of Cortez. We've got a desert there. We made a desert, and deserts can be wonderful if they're supposed to be deserts, but when deserts are supposed to be wetlands, wetlands are supposed to be wetlands and they become deserts, it's not a very nice thing. And fundamentally, you're talking about $17 million to buy that water rights, and with this binational agreement with Mexico imminently about to be signed, this is a very practical step that allows you to avoid politics, that allows you to just get something done and demonstrate to the people that you can do things and you can bring people together to make a difference and not just sit around and get depressed about it. So that's the whole vibe on this picture. I hope you enjoy the movie. Very inspired by what you're doing. Thank you for presenting. I enjoyed that a lot. So we'll talk after the movie. Thank you very much.